So we're going to talk about listening today and want to lead off just with a question. How can you tell when someone is really listening? Not how can you tell when they're not. How can you tell when they're really... you can answer it that way too. What do you notice when... What's that? Eye contact. Yes, yes. That's good. Anything else? When they repeat it back? Yeah. Good. They ask questions about what you shared or just about what they're interested in? Relevant questions. Probably about what you shared though, right? Yeah. What else? What do you notice when you notice listening is happening? Accurate empathy. Okay. They're not like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened. You're like, it's not that big a deal. No, it's terrible. You should be so upset. I'm really okay. That would be inaccurate empathy, right? Yeah. Yeah, so I think we're interested when we communicate in moving past the mechanics of just kind of taking in sound vibrations. I actually looked up listening on Wikipedia this week. That's how a lot of my sermon process starts. And it talks about three phases of listening. One was alerting, which is just like what animals do. So they hear something, they're like, you know, is that a threat or is it not? Oh, okay, it's not. I'll continue to do whatever I was doing before. Like when we're in our home, maybe we hear a door open or something in the night, or we think we do and our heart starts racing. That's alerting. And then from there is deciphering. So we start to kind of digest the sounds and make sense of them. Like, okay, what does this mean? Should I get out of bed? Should I call 911? Should I try to breathe and go back to sleep if I can? And then the third one is understanding, which is just starting to really process how we experience what the other person's sharing with us, or how are they experiencing it. So we're actually trying to, and we'll talk about this more, we're trying to get into their shoes a little bit and understand what's going on. And I think probably what most of us want in listening is we would like to feel understood, and we would like to know that someone, maybe not everybody, but someone gets us, like someone knows us on a little bit of a deeper level. Recently, someone asked me if deep listening is something people have a natural inclination toward or if it can be learned. So are you just either born a good listener or could you develop that? And I said, yes. I actually think I've graduated from being a poor listener to a mediocre listener. My wife can attest this. In college, I was very much an internal processor, so I didn't really grasp the concept of processing out loud. So Jenna, my wife, when we were dating, she would process out loud. I'm like, what is she doing? What does she want? Like, what's going on? Like, I didn't know what was happening. And then I like tried it and I was like, this is amazing. Like, I'm so much clearer than what I did just in my head. This is really helpful. So I think this idea of holding space is something I've come to value over time, because I've seen these really patient souls just listen to me deeply. And I've experienced healing in God in the presence of their listening. So I think the value is pretty high. Thoreau said, the greatest compliment that was ever paid me was when one asked me what I thought and intended my answer. One of the human things I notice over time is that we have a hard time listening to the people closest to us. Have you noticed that? Like, after we've kind of been around each other for a while, somehow it affects our listening. I've heard Gideon share, I think, something from NPR, like we go deaf to the sound of our spouse's, or the pitch of our spouse's voice. I think that wasn't a theory, right? That was something you heard on that was NPR, yeah. And so I've seen that, the people close to me, I have trouble hearing what they're actually saying sometimes. Like, I see their mouth moving and there's sound coming out, but I just don't know what's going on here. So I've started from time to time to actually make a conscious effort to listen better to those close to me. So about a week ago, I was talking or taking a walk with my 11-year-old daughter, and I decided that I really hadn't tuned into her in a while. So I was like, I'm just going to try to listen better. So we got into this really fun conversation, and Gracie asked me, if I could change anything in history, what would it be? And I said, I was really tired, like my brain was moving really slow. And I said, I'm not sure, how about you? And she had like obviously been thinking about it. And I said, did you guys do this in school? She said, no. I was like, okay, well, how about you? And she said, I'd make it so there wasn't any oil. Oh, okay. Well, how would you do that? She said, well, I'd go back to when God was making the earth. And like we're walking, right? And she kind of hunkers down a little bit. And she said, I go back to when God was making the earth. And she hunkers down and she like elbows me and she says, he says, hey, buddy, are you sure you really want to do that? Like to God, right? I was like, this is fantastic. And I'm dying laughing. And I said, well, how do you think God would respond to that? You know, I'm just completely curious about this hypothetical history-changing moment. And she got really thoughtful, really serious. And she said, well, I think he'd be really confused. And that was it. That was the comment. It's like, man, I should do this listening stuff more often. But today we're actually going to lean into a snapshot of what it looks like to listen in three primary spheres of our life. What does it look like to really listen to ourselves, to listen to our life? What does it look like to listen to others more deeply and then also to listen to God? And I think when we do this and when we kind of practice in these different areas, we begin to become more discerning as a people. And I think we begin to experience a freedom to make choices that aren't governed just by our past or some fantasy of our future, but they emerge in the deep grace of the present moment. In our brief story today, it's really short. It's just this little snapshot. We're going to see Jesus making a series of decisions that are informed by listening in these areas. So let's take a look. I'll invite you to read aloud with the people next to you, as is our custom. So our story starts with Jesus slipping away into the dark of morning to be alone. And I often wonder, I've read this story a few times, and I wonder, how did he know it was time to be away? And I think it was because he listened to himself. So it says in verse 35, very early in the morning while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. So just to give you a picture like of what's happening on either end of this moment in Jesus' life, it happens in the middle of all these impossible things, like one after the other. So he's been out meeting some people. He's been finding the people nobody would ask to be their followers, the people who didn't have a rabbi. He's like, those are the ones I want. So they're pretty rough around the edges. So he's spending time with them, drawing them in. And then he starts out, as he encounters unclean spirits, he's casting them out. He's making people whole. He's healing person after person. And he goes to the home of a couple of his followers. I think it's Simon and Andrew. And even one of them, their mother-in-law has a fever. He's like, hey, I know you've had a really long day. Do you think this would really help me out with my wife if you'd heal my mother-in-law? He's like, all right. It didn't say all of that, but I'm just imagining that might have been part of it. So it's like wherever he goes throughout this kind of series of events, they're just bringing him all the sick, all the demon-possessed, and he's just healing and healing. Verse 33 of chapter 1 says, by the evening, the whole city was gathered at the door, like everyone. So even where he goes to sleep, people are flooding him. And he's telling people to not say anything. And I think it's because he has limits. Like he has real limits. And he's getting overwhelmed by this ministry of physical healing. So a couple chapters later in Mark, this kind of continues after he has his time away. And we see Jesus actually at the end of those limits. It says he was healing so many people in chapter 3, verse 20, like he had stopped eating. He actually had to be pulled away. He had to be restrained by family, by friends. And those close to him said he's out of his mind. He's so overextended. He's so past his limits. That's super encouraging to me, because central to our narrative of who Jesus is he shows us what it is to struggle as a person and to completely learn how to trust and lean on God in the middle of that. So in the middle of all this doing, Jesus knew he needed to sneak away. He listened to himself, or we're going to talk about he empathized with himself. So another way of thinking of listening is empathy. And empathy is the ability to understand another's experience from within their frame of reference, to put yourself in their shoes, or go to a show in whatever footwear they want to wear. But what does it mean that Jesus listened to himself, that he empathized with himself? We have kind of a visual here of, we're going to kind of fill this in as we go today. But empathy with this, with ourself is just that, the ability to understand our experience from within our own frame of reference. I think a lot of us have trouble staying in our own shoes. Like some of us are so good at empathizing with others, we just live in other people's shoes all the time, and we rarely even visit our own footwear. We're like, yeah, oh yeah, you know, we're just like all these different places at once. But Jesus empathized with his need to get away. He heard it and he acted on it. It's pretty easy, right? It's easy to get away, pull away, unplug. Yeah, sure. Well, just in case it's not for you, it's not for me, I want to talk about just a couple challenges with empathizing with ourselves. The first I already mentioned is that we over-empathize with others and their expectations of us. So what would have happened if Jesus had waited for others to be okay with him pulling away, with him turning off his phone or shutting off Facebook or just taking off? Like, what would have happened if he waited for that to happen? What do you think? Do you think he ever would have done it? I don't think he would have. Because you see the need just pressing in, and it never would have been satiated. There just would have been more and more and more people. I think sometimes we get so locked into kind of the stream of connection or empathy with others' expectations, or fearful of whether they're going to judge us if I don't get right back to them or if I'm not available. You know, have you ever just turn your phone back on and then, you know, or turn it off and then turn it back on hours later, and you get all these like, where have you been? I'm so worried about, you know, kind of thing. So it's easy, I think, to wait and wait for permission outside of ourselves to rest or to pull away. And maybe we are prone to do what Jesus does, is to over-empathize with other people's expectations or needs until we're out of our minds. Like myself included, sometimes we just wait until we're completely out of our minds and people are like, go, just take care of yourself, get away. The other barrier I experience with self-empathy is the tendency to minimize our thoughts, emotions, and gut. Like sometimes we're masterful at trying to kind of counter ourselves with comparisons, right? Well, I'm tired, I'm hurting, but who am I to complain? You know, my life isn't as bad as fill in the blank, right? So that's super not helpful though, right? Like it doesn't actually help us to dismiss ourselves, to get out of our shoes if we do that all the time. So we stay on this kind of hamster wheel. I think the other reason, or the other factor in self-empathy that's hard is, I've been listening to a podcast with an Irish theologian, Peter Collins, and he says we're all haunted houses full of ghosts. So, and our ghosts are people we've hurt, loved, and lost. They're just experiences we've had that are too difficult to look at. He says we'd rather do anything, we'd rather try everything rather than letting our ghosts catch up with us and make peace with them. And it's kind of a neat voice, I think, in the conversation right now. He's actually a Christian who's kind of anti-heaven. let me tell you what he means by that. He pushes back on the idea that faith is the set of beliefs that ensures eternal life. And so this is something he said in his podcast, and I just love his accent. I'm terrible at it, but I'm going to try it. He says, I'd be a devil if I promised you an eternally shallow life. That would be an eternal hell. You know, sorry. I just had to do it. So for him, Christianity is a way of being in the world that helps us experience the depth of our life. It's much more about today. Like, God is so interested in helping us sink in and look at hard stuff and integrate and heal and be whole, like, more than we can even imagine. So I want to share, what does this look like to move into empathy with self? I actually walked with someone a while ago and asked permission to share the story. They live in another place. But I want to, it's a hard story to share, so I'll just kind of preface it with that. Someone whose kind of marriage is falling apart over time. But I want to talk about it as what does it look like when we are completely empathizing with another person and we don't listen to anything else. So this changed names, but this is, I'll say, the story of Felicia. Struggling for 3 years in an emotionally abusive marriage with a young daughter who was getting a lot of the brunt of it. They tried 6 different counselors, tried doing more and more. Felicia did, only to see her spouse do less and less. And she felt such a guilt about moving forward with some space, with some separation. So what kept her stuck in this overt abuse was this empathy with her spouse. He said, oh, but he's hurting so much. He's so sad. He's so broken. He's in such a dark place. And on and on and on. And I watched over time her life just sink and sink and sink. And I asked her one day, I just said, so what about you? And she said, I'm exhausted. I'm hopeless. I'm being sucked down. I feel it, you know. And it's felt this way, now that I talk about it, it's felt this way like 10 years now. And by the way, one of the ways we can tell we need to pull away, we need some solitude, some time to empathize, is we can't tell what's your stuff and what's my stuff. So I start to blame you for my stuff, or I start to take responsibility for your crap. My stuff's crap too. That's one of the ways we can tell we need some space to pull away, is we can't differentiate the two. So over the 3 years of meeting with her, everything was getting worse and worse. Felicia began to do more and more, take a job she hated, quit grad school, be home more, purchase a bigger home to try to help, and things got worse and worse and worse until she started to tune in to her true self, to herself, her truth of this experience. She struggled wickedly with minimizing her pain until she really listened to the depth of it from within her own context. So she finally got back in her own shoes, if you will, and from there was able to do this next thing that Jesus does. So Jesus felt something. Maybe he felt overwhelmed by the need of others. I mean, maybe it was just like, oh man, I've got to just respond. But he felt something that he listened to. Maybe it was a feeling, a thought, an instinct, but he knew it was time to pull away. It was time to sneak away while everybody was asleep and to listen. And out of that time alone, he emerges with renewed clarity of his life's purpose, his work. So how did Jesus know what to do? He listened to God. In verse 35, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." That's how I hear that verse. Everyone's looking for you. Where the hell have you been? And Jesus replied, "Let's go somewhere else, to the nearby village, so I can preach there also. That's why I've come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. It simply says he prayed. And out of this, he's able to make directional decisions to refocus his life. And I submit to you that Jesus actually got off track sometimes with his calling. Because out of this time, he says, let's go somewhere else. We're in the wrong place. It's time to move on. I find this reassuring, the idea that maybe Jesus might have wandered about a little bit in his calling, that it took him some time to figure it out, and then he even had to kind of check in and kind of write the course a little bit. And we'll circle back to this, but I'm coming up on 40, and I feel like I'm just getting close to my calling finally. Maybe. I don't know. But let's lean into the type of prayer Jesus was praying. So Jesus from time to time alluded to knowing God's word. So how? In John 8, 27 through 29, we see that he heard them. That's how he knew. They did not understand that he was speaking to them about the Father. So Jesus said, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will realize that I am he, that I do nothing on my own, but I speak these things as the Father instructed me, and the one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone. So there's lots and lots of ways to listen to God. So I'm going to just share an experience I had practicing this. So on Tuesday mornings from 7 to 8, there's a group meeting here for contemplative prayer or centering prayer. And we've been like practicing this. So there was a reading that came up a couple weeks ago. I'm going to share a part of it. And the reading talks about when we experience listening prayer, it's kind of like dropping a ball. You don't have to throw it. You're just dropping a ball. You're just sinking in. And there's just a grab. There's something in us that longs to just rest in God. But what happens is a lot of times we try to let go. We try to drop the ball, but then we catch it. We're like, oh, let me try that. And we just kind of keep doing that. So this is just talking about what does it look like to kind of experience that gravity of allowing ourselves to sink into who God really is. So I think I've got a quote. Yep. So since the will is designed for infinite love and the mind for infinite truth, if there is nothing to stop them, then they tend to move in that direction. It is because they are all wrapped up in other directions that their freedom to go where they are naturally inclined is limited. During the time of centering prayer, these faculties regain that freedom. The chief thing that separates us from God is the thought that we are separated from Him. If we get rid of that thought or we drop the ball, it's funny how, you know, dropping the ball is not a positive thing in our culture, but in this, it really is. Our troubles will be greatly reduced. We fail to believe that we are always with God and that He is part of every reality. The present moment, every object we see, our inmost nature are all rooted in Him. But we hesitate to believe this until personal experience gives us the confidence to believe in Him. This involves the gradual development of intimacy with God. God constantly speaks to us through other people and external events, as well as from within. The experience of God's presence activates our capacity to perceive Him in everything else. Isn't that kind of profound? The reason we gather, the reason we want to experience God is because it wakes us up to the fact that there's all this communication happening all the time. We're just utilizing other faculties. So this kind of awakens the part of us that can hear, that can see God's movement and the movement of the Holy Spirit in life. In people, events, and in nature, we may enjoy union with God in any experience of the external senses as well as in prayer. Centering prayer is a way of awakening to the reality in which we are immersed. We rarely think of the air we breathe, yet it is with us and around us all the time. In similar fashion, the presence of God penetrates us, is all around us, is always embracing us. Our awareness, unfortunately, is not awake to that dimension of reality. So we drop the ball. We let go, but we keep trying to catch it. So listening prayer is essentially letting the ball fall all the way down. Okay, so this was read, and then we sat for 20 minutes in silence. And the idea is you would kind of have a word that symbolizes your intention. So I was like, I'm exhausted. What's my word? So love. Love's a good word. So I picked love. So I was sitting there at home, so tired. Love, you know, dropping the ball again. And I catch it. Man, I could use some coffee. Love. Drop the ball. Tea? Love. I started thinking about my day. I'm like, man, I've got a lot of love. Just let it go. You know. Started thinking about, you know, something with my kids. Love. Again, trying over and over just to find some way to kind of rest. My mind just going, going, going. Finally, I was getting really frustrated with this whole thing I was trying to do and all this. And I took this really deep breath. And I came back. And my word changed to loved with a D at the end of it. And then I started thinking about stuff. So my mind's still working, right? So I started thinking about what my stuff. And I heard the word loved. You're loved. I was like, oh, that's kind of different. And then I thought about, you know, my kid and loved. He's loved. She's loved. Thought about my wife. She's loved. I thought about this person. Loved. And you're loved. And that person's loved. And there was just this shift from scarcity to abundance because it was just so clear. God was saying, you are not the source. Stop trying. Stop it. And that, just that subtle kind of thing is kind of what we're talking about when we talk about listening to God. I think I might have another fancy diagram in there somewhere, maybe. So listening to God is starting to empathize with wisdom or with the truth. So insofar as we tend to empathize with other people and their truth, you know, so there, one movement is we begin to learn how to hear ourselves, but it's not enough just to hear ourselves. Like, I think we actually also need to hear God's wisdom. So back to Felicia, my difficult story here. So when she pulled away, from abuse, she felt horribly guilty because she was empathizing with all the messages that were still running through her head. You don't love me, you're abandoning me, my dark sour, why are you doing this to me? And I just asked her, what's the truth of your situation? And she said, it's actually not that I'm abandoning him. I'm just creating congruence with his decisions to stay in darkness and addiction and to be hurtful. And I've tried so many different things. I've changed so many different things and nothing's moved on his end. So I asked, so what would it look like for you to empathize with the truth more, to empathize with wisdom? And then that created some movement and hopefulness in a person I hadn't seen any in like 2 to 3 years. So I don't think that question was from me. And I, you know, so I'll just say this too, ignoring wisdom, like we all do it a lot, you know, a lot. It isn't always like harmful. Sometimes it's just a delay or a distraction from really embracing our deepest desires and calling in life. Sometimes it's just satiating ourselves with something because we don't know how to lean into the other. So listening to God, empathy with wisdom, though, is how Jesus knew what to do. But I suggest equally important to that type of knowing is knowing what not to do, what not to expend our resources on. I think sometimes we start to think, oh, maybe I do want to explore this calling, this way to serve people or give back a little or heal the earth or something. Maybe I do want to do that. Maybe I do want to help out Vox a little bit more. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. So we just try to throw it on top of everything else, and then it just all becomes a burden. Like, it's kind of like service is a great honor, but when we just add it and we just keep adding and we don't make a hard decision to take something out, then it starts to become a burden. It starts to become something we avoid. And so part of the discernment listening is also knowing what to take out of our life sometime and what not to do. So just looking at this, Jesus knew what not to do by listening to other people in a paradoxical way. In verse 36, Simon and his companions went to look for him. When they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." And Jesus replied, "Let's go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I've come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues. So Jesus listens to his need to be away, listens to God, and now he's clear on his purpose. So we see that when he does this, he does the exact opposite. When he listens to them, he does the exact opposite of what they suggest, which is really interesting. They're looking for him to heal people. That seems like a pretty good thing, don't you think? And Jesus responds, yeah, let's get out of here. I mean, would you be a little surprised? Like, you're lining people up. You're getting everybody in a line, maybe 100 people or something. Like, man, this is going to be so great. We're going to do this great thing. And he's like, yeah, we're not going to do that now. We're going to go somewhere. They're like, well, they've been waiting. What's going on? You know what's interesting to me and puzzling is how shy Jesus is about his healing ministry. Like, throughout the accounts of his life, if you read the Gospels, he's always telling people to keep quiet about it. Or he's moving on in this instance when it interferes with this deeper purpose, which is to teach and preach. Which, in my mind, when I think of healing and teaching and preaching, I think healing's better. Don't you? Like, if I could heal, I think I'd be out doing that, you know. I don't know. So what was it? But to him, when he looked at the two and he listened to God, he said teaching was more important than physical miracles. So if all he had, and I actually wonder if all he had been was a great healer, I don't think we would care that much. Like, I don't think history would remember him or take him seriously in the way that they do now. And I would submit to you that his subversion of religious oppression and spiritual abuse was more radical than all of his healing miracles combined. And in some ways, that part of his ministry was a distraction. In verse 38, he says, let us go somewhere else to the nearby villages so I can, what, heal? No. So I can preach there also. That is why I have come. He came to preach a message so dangerous that he was murdered for it, not for healing, for his preaching, for his teaching. So if we think we know who God is, and it's not more radical and subversive than physical healing, I'd say that we've kind of done the same thing the people of Jesus' day were prone to, that we've actually fallen asleep to what's real. I almost wonder sometimes, too, when I think of Jesus' healing ministry, I read it in this light. If that was just something he couldn't help but do because he could, like because he had true compassion, he couldn't just be around all that and not do it. So I feel like he's like, all right, I'm going to help you out. Shh, don't tell anybody. And then they went and blabbed it. And then he's got, you know, thousands of people. He's like, oh, I can't teach here anymore. I got to move on. I wonder sometimes if that's why we don't see much of it now, or as much in the way we read about in the Gospels. Because it's maybe not central to God making the earth new. I'm not sure. But Jesus listening to others, really hearing what they expected, they made his direction clear. So I got one more maybe one more after this. So this is that empathy with others. So I think when we empathize with others, it helps us love them better, which is really great because we usually love people according to what we want. In fact, if you want to know how to love someone close to you, just think about all the things they do for you that annoy you and do those for them. It really works. It's great. And then ask for the same. Like, my wife will kind of tease me or be sarcastic with me. And I really love it. Like, I light up. And she, I don't know if she hates it. She doesn't really appreciate it. Not the way I do, you know. So I know when she's doing that, she's kind of being uncomfortable. To say, hey, jerk. And I just glow. Thanks, babe. Appreciate that. You know me. It's really good. The other thing empathizing with others do, though, is it allows us to differentiate their path from our path. So spiritual discernment happens for us when we practice listening in these different areas. So when we only empathize with ourselves, I think that's where we become really protective, maybe a little narcissistic or kind of ego protection-centered, if you will, and our world shrinks. And if we only empathize or listen to others, then we tend to kind of run ourselves ragged to please or react to others. And then if we only empathize with the truth, we kind of become these bobblehead I always have this image of these talking heads, used to be one, where you're kind of disconnected and you're just like this person that nobody feels safe around and nobody wants to know, and you don't really want to know yourself actually after a while. But what does it look like to practice this together? Like to lean into an area of where do I need to listen or empathize more? Okay, this is my last kid's story. So I told this story a couple weeks ago. I'm driving to school, and I was like, all right, I'm going to try to listen better to my kids. And I had this really funny moment with my daughter. And the next day I was like, man, how did that story happen? Like, what happened? And then I remembered the story that prefaced it. And actually, like, this doesn't happen very often. I started crying. It's like, what is going on? And I'm also just going to preface it and say, God's real to me because he prevents me from screwing my kids up too much. So my 11-year-old daughter got in the car. She's super excited. She's got her STAR test. I don't know if some of y'all know what that's like, the state test. It's sealed, so I think they had to like open it with the kids. So we're driving away from school. She opened it. She's really excited. Oh, look at my math score. Look at my science score. You know, super excited. And then just like her affect falls. She gets really quiet. And then she seems kind of down. She says, my teacher told us to ignore this last part. I was like, well, what is it? And she says, I don't know. It just says some stuff about me. I don't know what it means. So I'm driving and I'm like, well, what is it? She's like, I don't know. And she's like moving on. So we get to a stoplight. I take a look at it and it's a scale that measures body mass index. And she was a little bit high on it. And I asked her, are you uncomfortable about your body? Like, I'm tired. Again, I don't really know how to soften these things. So I'm just like, ask a really direct question. Again, I don't know what I'm doing. And she's like, kind of squirms, like, well, kind of, you know. And of course, like every kid is, they're starting to go into puberty, all that. But my teacher told us to not pay attention to it because it doesn't measure muscle density. God bless her teacher. I love her teacher at this moment. So I asked her, I said, are you concerned that you're not pretty or something? Like, again, I know there's a better way to do these things. I just don't know what that way is. And I mean, are you like comparing yourself to your friends? Because she has these tiny little stick friends and all this. And she's like, kind of, you know. I can only imagine how terrible this conversation is for her, actually, like as I think back. So I just said, you know, comparing ourselves, I actually think God kind of helped me out here. It isn't a really accurate way to measure beauty. And she's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, in our culture, we have such a tiny, narrow view of beauty that most of us actually don't agree with it. And very few, if any of us, actually fit into it. I'd say none of us do, actually. And then I just said, do you know, I think your mom is beautiful. She's like, yeah. I smiled real big. I said, no, like, so beautiful. She smiled. She said, yes. I said, and again, I don't know, some psychologists come tell me this is a bad way to go later. I said, you know, you have the same body type that she does. And she says, yeah, like, I hope I'm beautiful like her someday. And I said, do you know that I think you're so beautiful right now? And she just beamed. She's like, really? I was like, yeah. She gave me permission to tell her the truth. Yeah? So discernment happened for me because I heard myself get furious. I was ready to burn the STAR test down to the ground. Like, this freaking piece of paper. Like, I was like, okay, this isn't going to be helpful. Take a breath. I was broken. And then I calmed down and I heard my daughter question who she was. What was true. And then I heard God say, that's utter BS. And here's how you can let her know. So what if it's true? What if God thinks we're so damn beautiful? Like he'd die to subvert any system that tells us otherwise just so it can sell us a bunch of crap we don't need. I submit to you that this is what Jesus was becoming ever clear about, that people don't know what God's really like. So rather than running to God or letting go and falling in, they're repulsed. So when he was away, he realized there are so many bad stories told and lived about God and so few good ones. So he just started telling these little stories, like these parables, these little time bombs that went off in people's mind later and say, wait a minute, you mean what I thought about God isn't real? It isn't true? So he told stories about God as like a father waiting on a porch for his wayward child, his son, who burned his life to the ground in the name of pleasure. And then when he saw that child on the hill, he came running out and he threw a party. And his kid's like blubbering with these excuses. Oh, yeah, I've got this speech rehearsed. You know, you were right, da-da-da-da-da. He's like, I don't care, you're back. I've been waiting. Man, it's so good to see you. I missed you. People wanted to know how to pray, and he said, you see the children? So in this culture, the children need to be invisible. A good kid was an invisible kid. You see the invisible ones? You see how they trust you? I don't know why they trust you, but you see that? That's how to pray. You see that guy over there who is choking back shame, and he's saying, I've had a life that I just wish I could do over. And he's just weeping. And he's bringing his pain to God. And Jesus looked at me and says, see that? That's a prayer. Bring your life to God. Don't buy into some crap that you have to hide it somewhere else. Bring it. Bring it all. God can handle it. So Jesus looked around. And he just knew that, yep, that's it. This has got to stop. That's the most important thing I can do, more than heal people, more than settle down and start a family. I can tell stories about God that crack hearts of stone wide open, that give people back a heart of flesh. God didn't create these systems of spiritual usury. He didn't create the title loan company that will give my sister a $400 loan if she puts up the title to her car at a 400% interest rate so she can provide food for her four children. God didn't create that. God didn't create a church that does that. But he'll throw himself under the bus for it to give us a different option. He said, I will absolutely die so you don't have to do that anymore. So today, you and I are full of beauty and light. And what we most need is free. It's free. Except for those lies that bind us, that cut us in our complicity with them. But when we really listen, when we start to hear that faint echo again, loved. And you're loved. And I'm loved. And she's loved. And he's loved. You just forgot. And then I think it almost becomes like we're remembering something. I invite you to pray with me. God, please give us the grace to see the simplicity set before us, that we could walk in lightness and with lightness that is truly light. Help us to know where to cultivate deeper listening and deeper empathy. Is it with ourselves? Do we need to get in our own shoes a little bit more? Is it with your wisdom, with others? We pray that you would guide us as we discover our small part in remaking the world with you, that we could fall into your beauty, your vision of a beautiful world. Like you see what it can be every day and you invite us into that. We ask all this in the joy of the Father and the Son, Holy Spirit. Amen.